Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is our food system failing us? Corn and soybeans take up more than half the farmland in the United States. Large commercial growers receive more than 60% of U.S. agricultural subsidies, despite being just over 12% of the total number of farms. And agricultural runoff is considered the leading source of contamination in 41% of lake acres and nearly half of river miles with unacceptable water quality. On top of all that, my guest will tell us, far too many low-income Americans experience food insecurity or lack access to fresh, healthful choices when they do have money to spend. Orrin B. Hesterman is founder, president, and CEO of Fair Food Network. His new book is called Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. Orrin, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Chris.
You argue here that we need to engage as fair food citizens. What does that mean?
When I say engage as fair food citizens, I mean that the single most important step for each of us to take if we want to help create a food system that's healthy and sustainable for everybody is to make the shift from conscious consumer to engaged citizen. So that in addition to thinking about what we're purchasing at the store, what we're putting into the refrigerator, what we're putting on our dinner plates, we also have to make this transition to engage as citizens in our communities, with the institutions where we live, work, play, and worship, and with public policy.
I want to talk about how we got the food system that exists today in this country. Starting decades ago, producers began focusing on efficiency, on high yield, on convenience for consumers. In and of themselves, these things seem to make sound sense. Why are they not beneficial for the food system as a whole?
When we were first putting together our food policies as a nation that still in large measure have come through to today's policies, it was primarily about producing as much as we could as cheaply as possible and really utilizing the great natural resource base we have for agriculture in this country, our rich soil, our plentiful water, our great technology, and the innovation of our farmers. And This is really great. I mean, we've created a food system unparalleled to any that the world has ever seen in terms of productivity. The challenge we have now, Chris, is that our context for that food system has changed. We now have to focus on stewarding our precious natural resources for the future, our soil, our water. And we know that we've created a food system that has great disparity, that, as you said in the introduction, where millions of our inner-city residents and some in rural areas as well live in what U.S. Department of Agriculture has termed food deserts. So we know it's a system that needs new policy because the time has changed, the context has changed.
So you mentioned, Orrin, our natural resources. By any account, we are blessed in this country with a great abundance of arable land. We have diverse climate conditions that allow us to grow a huge variety of produce. Why are we cultivating so much corn and soy?
Well, one of the reasons is because we've had decades of public policy that helps drive the system in that direction. That when we have farm subsidies and other kinds of direct payments to farmers who are producing just a very few crops like corn and soybeans, coupled with the land, the soil, the climate that is very conducive to those crops, it has driven us in that direction. And these are also two crops that really help our balance of payments as a country because we are able to sell a lot of corn and soybeans for animal feed primarily outside the United States. The challenge is that if we look to the future of the food system we need now and in the future to feed a growing population, we need to do it in a way that is much more careful about stewarding our natural environment and that is much more careful about making sure everybody has access to healthy food.
How does consolidation of the meat packing and distribution industry contribute to potential hazards with regard to consuming these products?
You know, we've been thinking a lot about that, especially as we hear about the kind of food safety issues that are happening in this country and other places in the world. And one way to actually address food safety issues is to diversify our system rather than thinking we can have things so heavily concentrated and pinpoint the sources of our contamination. And I think about, for example, last summer when we had 500 million eggs contaminated with salmonella that came from basically five production facilities in Iowa, and that it's likely that if that same kind of production was much more dispersed, not so highly concentrated, that we would be able to, we would not have such a wide spread of potential disease with tainted food as we would see with highly concentrated operations.
So producers might say, well, changing the food system to diversify means we all pay more for food. Is that necessarily a consequence of the changes you're talking about?
I'm not really sure it is. A lot of people think that what this means is that we have to pay more money for food. But I start looking at studies like a recent study done up in Vermont where some students actually went out and looked at the price of locally grown fruits and vegetables at farmers markets and compared it with the price of those same items in supermarkets nearby. And for those items that were grown in so-called conventional manner, in other words, not certified organic, the price difference was, the prices were relatively the same. Might be a little higher for one, a little lower for another. But especially when they looked at organically produced fruits and vegetables, the price at the farmer's market on average was close to 40% lower than the price in a supermarket. So we start to see those kind of studies, and we start to look at studies that actually indicate that producing our farm products under sustainable and even organic methods does not mean a reduction in yield. I'm not convinced that this means much higher prices for food.
So why, for the most part, do I have to go to the farmer's market to get this locally grown stuff? Why can't I buy it at the grocery store on the corner?
Well, hopefully that's going to be changing. Part of the reason is because when we have 47% of all of our retail grocery controlled by just four companies, which is the situation right now in the United States, the entire distribution system for food starts to be controlled by the supermarket retail industry. Now, the really cool thing is that we are starting to see some of our even largest food retailers understand that more local and regional production, selling the food close to consumers, close to where it's grown, is not only meeting a consumer demand for locally grown food, but it also makes sense economically, especially as fuel prices increase. Being able to transport food fewer miles from where it's grown to where it's sold and eaten makes a lot of sense.
So another thing that really worries you here is pollution. We'll set aside for a moment the question of contamination of food products themselves that are contaminated in the field. But rivers and lakes are in serious jeopardy because of the high yield, high efficiency methods that we're using in a lot of traditional farming practices now. Can you talk about that?
So we know that not only is it rivers and streams, but, for example, it's predicted this year that the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, the northern part of the Gulf of Mexico, right where the Mississippi River comes into the Gulf, the dead zone, which means an area where it is so lacking in oxygen that nothing can live there, no fish, no shellfish, nothing, that this dead zone, largely created by agricultural runoff, all up and down the Mississippi watershed, it will be larger this year than it's ever been before, primarily because of all the flooding that happened along the Mississippi this year. But this is a dead zone that last year was the size of the state of Massachusetts. And we know that we can do a better job. We know that we can do a better job in managing our fertilizer nutrients. We can do a better job in managing the pesticides that we use. And we know it because we see it happening right now. I think, for example, of the and something I write about in the book is an example from Sysco, the largest food distributor to restaurants and cafeterias in the country. I'm sure many of you have seen the Sysco trucks running up and down the highways.
Sure.
Well, about 5 years ago, Cisco implemented what they call an Advanced Integrated Pest Management, or IPM, program, where every farmer and every processor producing or processing food for Cisco has to do so under very strict standards that were developed by the IPM Institute, the Integrated Pest Management Institute, a non-biased and third-party organization. And by looking at the results, the way Cisco talks about it is the estimated pounds of pesticides avoided. And, for example, just last year, almost close to 1 million pounds of pesticides were not used that would otherwise have been used because the acreage was under this kind of production. It's over 900,000 acres right now, which is over 6% of all of the acres of fruits and vegetables grown in the United States. So there's some really great solutions happening when large companies, as well as when individual consumers, get involved in shifting the way this food system is being produced.
So what motivates a Cisco to do this? Is it consumer pressure?
You know, it's a very good question, and you would think that it was consumers demanding it, but in this case, it wasn't. In this case, as I did the research on Cisco and have gotten to know the company and some of the leaders, it really started with Rick Schneiders, who was the CEO of Cisco for about 10 years. He retired in just a year ago. But during his tenure there, he started imagining how his company could actually play a role in helping relieve the burden of toxic pesticides and fertilizers and actually reduce its carbon footprint. And so he got together with some of the other leadership of that organization and started thinking about how they could do this. And his belief is that it's not only the right thing to do, but it's a great business model, because in the future, the businesses that are addressing environmental sustainability and more local and regional production and consumption are going to be those businesses that are going to be the most viable.
Is it actually easier for a very large company, provided that it has leadership that wants to be responsible and do the right thing, to make this shift than it might be for smaller producers?
I actually think it's possible for everybody, and the one of the keys here is that we need to think about how to shift our public policies. If we know that a more diverse agricultural system is more resilient. It's more resilient in terms of buffering against extreme weather. It's more resilient in terms of drought, and it's more resilient in terms of pest outbreaks. If we know that we need more diversity in our agricultural systems, then we should be creating public policy that encourages it and that supports it. And when we do this, we will see large farmers and small farmers become more diverse and follow a more ecological approach.
It is an interesting case study, though, because sometimes the debate gets very simplified and we assume that large food producers are sort of evil and inherently only out for profit, when in fact the arguments are often more nuanced than that.
Absolutely, and it's a point I really bring out in my book, that I think that for us to believe that small is beautiful and big is bad is a mistake, that there is room for small, large, and in-between to help make this shift in our food system, and it is so important that we do this. It's the system that all of us depend on three times a day, if we're lucky, and one that we need to get everybody involved in the change process, large and small.
Orrin B. Hesterman is my guest. He's president and CEO of Fair Food Network and author of the new book, Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. You can join us now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is President, Founder, and CEO of Fair Food Network, Oren B. Hesterman. His new book is called Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. If you want to join our conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. So, Oren, we really can't have this conversation without talking about this gigantic, every 5 years piece of legislation that is known in its shorthand term, the Farm Bill, plays a tremendous role in how the American food system is structured, and its effects go far beyond simply payments to farmers. Can you tell us basically what the Farm Bill is and what it includes?
Yes, you know, the Farm Bill, so it's this large omnibus piece of legislation. We reauthorize it every 5 years. It contains everything from direct payments to farmers and farm subsidies to crop insurance to resources for conservation and environment. But what many people don't understand is that the largest single authorization in the Farm Bill is actually what's called nutrition assistance, or what we've called food stamps in the past. And, you know, I really started thinking about this whole issue much differently. You know, I had been working as an agronomist for almost 20 years, but at age 36, I had a life-threatening illness. I was in the hospital with a flare-up of Crohn's disease so bad that my digestive system stopped working, and I was faced with the prospect of having my colon removed. And when the doctor finally felt that I could eat something again after pumping me full of prednisone, the meal that they served me is something that I knew. I mean, you know, roast beef, mashed potatoes, and a piece of cake made with white flour and white sugar. And I knew that's not what I needed to eat at that moment.
Yeah.
I was fortunate in that I could call a friend and ask her if she'd bring me some, you know, brown rice and steamed greens and tofu that I could eat. And fortunately, I have gotten better, and I am healthy as can be right now. But lying in the hospital during that week, I was thinking not only about how fortunate I am that I both know what to do to feed myself, to get myself healthy, but I had access to it. And I thought about all the people who don't, all the people who either don't know how to eat to keep themselves healthy, or if they do, they simply don't have access. And, you know, right now in this country, we have 44 million people who are now on food stamps, who have to rely all or in part on federal food assistance to buy the food that they need for their families. And in many places like Detroit, which is the city closest to where I live in Ann Arbor, there are many people who don't even have access to a supermarket. So they really can't access the healthy food they need. So the part of the Farm Bill that we are now focusing on at Fair Food Network, in addition to some of these other aspects that we've talked about, is to see what we can do to help make our nutrition programs, our food stamp programs, more effective, to help create greater access for low-income folks to be able to get the healthy food they need to get and keep their kids healthy.
You guys at Fair Food Network have a really interesting, I don't know if it's still considered a pilot program, but essentially it encourages food aid recipients to seek out local growers. Can you talk about Double Up Food Bucks and the effect they've had, at least in the state of Michigan?
Right. So Double Up Food Bucks is a program whereby anybody who brings their food stamp card to a participating farmer's market anywhere in the state, if they spend, say, $20 of their federal food assistance money off their card, they will get an additional $20 of Double Up Food Bucks. So you spend $20 and you get $40 worth of produce. That extra $20 can only be spent on Michigan-grown fruits and vegetables.
So that's good.
It's a way for us to encourage low-income families to bring their federal food dollars to a place where they can get healthy food for their families and put that money right in the pocket of local farmers, local agriculture, and the local food economy. And we think that this is a much more effective way to think about how to spend our federal food assistance dollars. And so we are now hoping that we can use the evaluation and the findings from our work in Michigan and in other states where this is starting to happen to help inform the reauthorization of the Farm Bill so we can get some policies that can both support healthier eating and support local agriculture at the same time.
Where does the money come from for those matching funds?
So far, the money for the matching dollars all comes from foundations. So right now, Double Up Food Bucks is being supported by 25 different foundations, many within Michigan, community foundations, private foundations, and some outside of the state as well. So we're using philanthropic dollars to demonstrate the feasibility and effectiveness of this kind of incentive approach and believe that we should also engage our public policymakers in this approach as well.
Have you also been able to track any health effects for the recipient population?
Not yet. That takes time. You have to do that over time. But
yeah.
what we can track is shifts in purchasing behavior in terms of buying more fruits and vegetables. And many of our public health colleagues tell us that if we can demonstrate a significant increase in purchase and consumption of fruits and vegetables, they know that that is going to create healthier outcomes down the road. They just know it. There's enough data, enough research on that. And, you know, in our first year of operation, when we compared some of the farmers' markets in Detroit and what they were selling to low-income families in 2009 before our program started, and then what was sold last year with our program in place, the increase in some cases was close to 400%. So we know that if we put this kind of incentive in place, people will use it. And what I love about this program is that every one of those dollars, not just the Double Up Food Buck dollars, but many of those federal food stamp dollars also go right into the pocket of local farmers to help support our local food economy, our local rural communities. So it's really a win-win-win kind of a project.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phones now to Doug in Dallas. Hello, Doug.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Mr. Hesterman.
Hello.
I was basically your white bread, meat, and potatoes kid growing up. And then when I was in the service in Asia, I grew to love rice. So we got all this emphasis on corn and soybeans and so on. Do we do anything to help those guys that are farming those things, potatoes and rice?
Well, again, if we can start focusing our policies on supporting a whole range of production. So, if we're going to create a more diverse and more ecologically sound system, one of the most important things we can do is create more complex crop rotations. You know, we shouldn't be growing the same crops in the same field year after year. In fact, the best, most successful systems would only have a crop in a field once out of every 3 or 5 years. So it means we need to be supporting farmers to grow many more types of crops. Now, we know that, you can't grow rice in every climate, so you got to grow the crops where the climate is right for it, the soil's right, and the water's right. But we can be doing a much better job than producing corn and soybeans on half of our acreage.
Is there any way that we can do a better job of encouraging farmers to not simply look at moving away from monoculture, but to have, say, animals raised on the same facility where you're raising crops so you've got the benefit of manure that's produced in the location where it can be used?
Absolutely, and it's some of the examples I write about in the book are farmers that have reintroduced livestock back onto farms that had gone just to pure grain production or pure corn and soybean production. On a smaller scale, when farmers are producing livestock on a smaller scale, one of the most important things we can do is to make sure that we have slaughterhouse and meatpacking facilities close enough to them that it's economically viable for them to produce their livestock and have them slaughtered, packed, and marketed close by. And it's something that's starting to happen. I love to talk about solutions and what I call solutionaries, those people who are finding ways to create solutions in this food system. And I think about a couple of situations like in the Hudson Valley of New York, where there are a lot of smaller scale livestock producers, and an organization now has created a mobile slaughterhouse so that rather than everybody having to haul their animals long distance to a slaughterhouse many miles away, this slaughter facility is on wheels. It gets moved from location to location in the Hudson Valley, and people can slaughter their animals through this mobile unit, which is USDA inspected, so everything is legal, and then it gives them a way to market what they're growing. So we have to think about this as a system. It's not just about the production. It's also about what it takes to process, distribute, and sell your products.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Deb in Dallas. Hey, Deb.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I have a question about kind of how you would define the word local. I was at Whole Foods the other day, and they had local grown tomatoes. Well, they were from Marfa, Texas, which is, what, like a 10-hour drive from here?
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of like, what's the logic there? It seems like local would be better to go ahead and go to Oklahoma, an hour and a half away, and get your food from there. I just felt like the reasonableness of that somehow was getting a little bit skewed.
You know, it's very tricky. Some of the labels that are being used right now in stores, and it's one of the reasons why whenever I can, I go to farmers markets close by, because I actually can meet the folks that are growing what I'm buying and find out where they're from, and then I know what I'm getting. The concept of local really differs depending on where you are. Just an example where I am in Michigan, most people think of locally grown in Michigan as if it's grown within the state. But if you go over the border to Northwest Ohio, what they say is, we consider local anything grown in Ohio or in any state that touches Ohio. So they take it broader than that. And in a state like Texas, you know, such a huge state, you're right. I mean, it can be much more local if it's grown in another state, depending on where you are, than all the way across the state of Texas. So I think it's important for each of us to take responsibility in knowing where our food is coming from, if we have that interest, and asking those questions.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go now to Cindy in Dallas. Hello, Cindy.
Yes, hi. I was wanting to find out how you feel about co-ops.
You're talking about places where people sort of pay into a system that grows food and produces food for a number of people who then take the produce back?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Warren?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that in many cases, cooperatively owned stores or cooperatively owned processing facilities by farmers are an excellent way to think about how to design our food system for the future. If I think about the principles that I believe in, equity, diversity, you know, economic viability, ecological integrity, these are all the kinds of principles that you can start embedding into a system when you have this kind of local ownership. You know, I love the idea about a co-op because it's really democracy at its best in our food system. The members and owners of the co-op have some measure of decision-making about what the co-op carries. Oftentimes, the prices that you can purchase food for at a co-op are going to be lower, because people are purchasing in quantity. So I think that co-ops are a great institution in our agriculture and food system, and I'd love to see more of them.
Speaking of institutions, this is something that is an important component of the book that we haven't really talked much about yet. Lots of food is purchased and prepared and served by some very large entities, things like school districts and universities. Talk about the changes that they can potentially make that affect not only the individuals to whom they're serving this food, but the industry as a whole.
Right. I mean, I think about, for example, something called the Real Food Challenge, which is right now about 3,000 college and university students around the country on 300 different campuses. And they are making a pledge to shift 20% of the $5 billion that is spent in university and college dining facilities by the year 2020. 20% of that, so $1 billion worth of purchasing power, to go to more local and sustainable sources. It's a great idea and something that college students anywhere in the country can get involved with. They can go to the Real Food Challenge, you know, on the web. They can find someone who's trying to organize that in their state, and so that's one thing that's happening in terms of college and universities. But I also think about what's happening in public schools. That I think it was eight years ago, we could only identify 4 farm-to-school projects in the entire country. That is a project that was connecting local farmers with their food directly into the food service of schools, elementary, middle schools, and high schools, to make sure those kids in those schools were getting locally grown and sustainably produced food. 8 years ago, only 4 projects. Right now, there are 10,000 in every one of the 50 states. And a great organization, the Farm to School Network, is working in every state now, helping parents and school administrators and school boards and farmers connect up and create more of those projects. I think about what's happening in hospitals as one institution, that there are over 350 hospitals now in North America that have signed on to a healthy food and healthcare pledge. You know, the story that I told about when I was in the hospital and the kind of food that was brought to me, I mean, my hope is actually I never have to go to the hospital again.
We'll hope that but, with you, yeah.
But for those of us who do find ourselves in the hospital, we would hope that in the future when we're served food in the hospital, that food is healthy, it's grown under sustainable or organic conditions, it's food that is supporting a healthy food system, not just the health of our bodies.
My guest is Orrin B. Hesterman, president and CEO of Fair Food Network. His new book is called Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. We'll take more of your calls at 1-800-933-5372 after the break. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Orrin B. Hesterman, president and CEO of Fair Food Network and author of Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable Food System for All. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Orrin, did the iteration of the Farm Bill that was passed in 2008 go very far toward correcting some of the shortcomings of previous legislation?
I would say we took some important steps in 2008. You know, I think of the Healthy Food Enterprise Development Program that is helping to fund startups in healthy food enterprise, especially for those who are living in so-called food desert communities. I thought that was a really good step. The Farmers Market Promotion Program got an increase in funding. It's a great program out of USDA that's helping many more farmers' markets come into being, and those that are in operation to equip themselves to be able to take electronic benefits or food stamps. But the basic structure, the basic bones of the Farm Bill, as you know, being primarily supporting direct payments and subsidies to very few types of agriculture, stayed in place. And so, you know, I believe that we are going to have to eventually fundamentally restructure our food and farm policy. It's going to be difficult to do in 2012 or 2013 when it's reauthorized because of so much focus right now on deficit reduction, but that could also create an opportunity.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we have Valerie on the line in Richardson. Hey, Valerie.
Hi. My question is, I've heard several experts in recent weeks urging that we buy locally at farmers markets, and I do shop at farmers markets, but as I've observed during many visits to the large one in Dallas, that many of the vendors, especially those who offer a wide range of fruits and vegetables in one stall, are actually selling produce that has been shipped in from as far away as California and New Jersey. I mean, the smaller farmers markets and are up in, you know, Coppell and up around do have very small booths, and you can tell they're locally grown. But the Dallas farmers market, you can, I'd say that most of the vendors don't sell locally grown produce.
Valerie, that's an interesting point, and I know that they do, they are required to sort of let you know. There's like a little sign over the stand to tell you that. But of course, you know, Orin, she makes the point, you can buy bananas at the Dallas Farmers Market, and you certainly can't grow them anywhere around here.
Right. I mean, I can buy pineapples at some of the farmers markets in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because in some farmers markets, like the largest farmers market in Detroit, there are sections of the market that they have designated as producer only. So if you go to that section of the farmer's market, you can be assured that what you're buying was grown by the people who are vending it. And then there are other sections of the market that are people can sell either what they grow or what they're, it's a sort of a buy and sell thing, what they're brokering,
mm-hmm.
or both. So I really believe you got to be careful. Even, you know, you don't have to be careful just at a grocery store. You got to be careful at a farmer's market. You got to ask the questions. If you want to buy locally grown produce, if you want to eat more seasonally, you got to be asking the questions even at a farmer's market.
We have an email here from Bill who says, do you think that locally produced produce will get more and more popular simply because it tastes so much better than commercially produced food?
We know that locally grown food is getting more popular for lots of reasons. And I think taste and freshness is key. I mean, it's why I would go to a farmer's market. I mean, it's difficult for me to find a tomato in season. Even during the season, it's hard for me to find a tomato in a grocery store that compares even close to what I can get at a farmer's market. So taste and freshness definitely will push this. In addition, there are a lot of people who are realizing that, listen, they want to support the local economy. They want to support local farmers and the local food system, job creation in our local communities and our rural communities surrounding our cities. And the way you do that is by putting the money in the hands of those farmers. Farmers in general in our country who are growing commodity crops and then having those crops just being sold on the open market and processed into all kinds of food, I think the current figure is out of every dollar spent on food, they might get less than 20 cents, something like 19 cents. Whereas if you go and buy at a farmer's market, that farmer's getting nearly 100 cents of every dollar you're spending. So that you're really supporting small business and local business when you shop at a farmer's market. So there are people who are helping to push sales of locally grown food because they know it's better for the economy as well as because it's better for taste and freshness.
Let's speak next on the phone with Maggie, waiting patiently in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I've been an organic gardener for a number of years now, and every year I try to push my garden a little further. But I am trying to set a good example. I am doing the edible estates approach. I'm growing on the side and the front of my yard, and it really does bring up conversation. A lot of people ask, you know, what I'm growing, or ask, oh, is that okra or whatever? They have a history. They remember farming or gardening when they were children, but it's kind of like women needing to learn to breastfeed now because of the bottle generation. It's like the grocery store generation. People are having to relearn how to garden. They're having to learn what they can grow and how to eat what they can grow, and making choices about what is too troublesome to grow. I don't do corn now because it's such a fussy, demanding crop, I find. Lots more water, lots more attention, and for a small yield. So my garden is based on what's easiest to grow here and what I get the best return from.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm right with you. I have exactly the same kind of garden at my house in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I took out lawn and shrubs and about 6 years ago put in a vegetable garden. And I get the same kind of, it's the total conversation starter in the neighborhood. You know, everybody is watching what I'm doing. Everybody is interested in it. They watch the garden grow. And then what I do whenever I'm, you know, if I have a great harvest of chard or kale, I make sure that my neighbors get some of it. So they're all participating in the whole process, even if they're not out there gardening. And fortunately, a few of my neighbors have started gardening too. And I also completely understand your thoughts about growing what's easiest to manage given a lifestyle. I had to think about that a lot this year because I'm on a lifestyle of a book tour this summer and spending a lot of time away from home. So I took about half my garden and put it into potatoes and onions this year because I figure those are two crops. As long as I can get a neighbor to water them if it doesn't rain, they can wait till the end of the season to harvest. So I applaud what you're doing and hope you keep it up.
Do you actually garden in your front yard, Orrin?
I do.
You know, there's some neighborhoods where there's a neighborhood association or this is not allowed. Is that another thing that we need to, you know, as in standing up as fair food citizens, do we need to say it's ridiculous that I can't grow food on my own land?
Absolutely. I mean, we should be, you know, we should be growing food wherever and whenever it's feasible. And I mean, I'm very fortunate. We have a neighborhood association where I live, but my neighbors love it. Hmm. You know, they love the fact that I took out lawn and I'm growing a garden. I took out another piece of lawn on the other side of the property and planted a few fruit trees. And, you know, it's the talk of the neighborhood. They love it.
You've bought them off with fresh kale.
Of course. And peaches when the peaches come in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes you have to use all kinds of methods of persuasion here.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jerry on the line in Waxahachie. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I just had a comment to make. I am a chef, and I work with a local group down here in Waxahachie where we put together a dinner for this year. It's going towards the Farm Truck Project, which is a nationwide project to kind of show people how they can garden anywhere. And the local farmers I'm working with, the proceeds are going to help start the project. But one of the challenges we have come in contact with is when we're putting the menu together, all of our food is local within a 50-mile radius, organic, and it's donated from local farmers who come to the dinner and kind of help teach about sustainability. But one issue we had this year was trying to find local honey. And I've heard some other callers make a comment about how they don't know exactly where their food is coming from. And we even, you know, came across that when we were trying to get local honey. It was coming from Oklahoma. It was coming from way down south in Texas. And, you know, we're closer to the Dallas area. So we had a real challenge in trying to actually get somebody that said that their honey was produced locally to actually have it produced locally.
Well, I know I live in East Dallas, and I know you can buy local honey there in some farmers markets. But I can understand, yeah, Orrin, sometimes when you commit yourself to eating everything locally, sometimes there are those products that you just can't find. What do you do when you come upon this?
Well, you know, again, I really believe that if we are going to shift the food system in the direction it needs to shift, we have to focus beyond our own plate and our own refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I really write a lot and talk a lot about this notion of engaged citizen, an engaged food citizen. Because it's not just about making sure that each of us is eating locally and sustainably. I actually think that it's great that we have a food system that is both global and local. I see nothing wrong with us being able to source food from distant places and places close by. The challenge we have is that in the way our food system has evolved, about 98% of our food system, if you look at the dollars moving through our system, are from that highly globalized, highly concentrated, highly mechanized system, highly chemicalized, and about 2% is coming from local, sustainable sources. And what I want to help us do is to create more balance create more balance so that I really don't, you know, if it turns out that some of what I eat is coming from a distance, I don't see a problem with it. But those things that I am able to source locally and seasonally, I'll do. I think it's all a matter of balance.
So if we want to pay close attention and have an impact on legislation that makes a difference here, where should we start? Do we join advocacy groups? Do we write to our legislators? What are the best ways to do this?
So I think that there are ways to start at the local level in terms of policies that protect farmland, and you can and policies that get more local food into schools, and that you can do locally. But I also think it is important for those of us who have the interest and ability and a little bit of time to engage with the broader and more overarching policies like the Farm Bill. In my book, I have a whole chapter on how to engage in the policy process, and I've listed several organizations like the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, for example, that has been working on creating healthier policies for our food system for quite some time. And there are organizations that would love your support. They would love your volunteer time. They would love your support in terms of letter writing, and they would love your donations. And so there are plenty of ways to get involved and engaged in the policy process. I think it's very important for Texans to get involved because Texas has traditionally been the Texas congressional delegation has traditionally been a very strong delegation when it comes to farm policy. And so those of us who can connect with our elected representatives and let them know that we want them to support a future farm bill that is creates greater access to healthy food for everybody that needs it, that creates a more diversity of approach in our food production system, and that creates a more environmental responsibility, that's a really good start.
We just have a few seconds left, but why do you think the political component has been left out of so many campaigns to get people to change the way they eat as individuals?
Well, I think that it has to do with how we think about food. And many authors and movie makers have pointed out the problems in the system, but very few of us have yet taken it to the next step of solutions. And solutions have to go beyond our dinner plate, have to go beyond our refrigerator. If we're really going to create the food system we need for the future, it means engaging as citizens.
Orrin B., I'm afraid we're out of time. I'm going to have to jump in here. Orrin B. Hesterman's new book is called Fair Food, Growing a Healthy, Sustainable System for All. Orrin, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Chris, you're very welcome.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.